the ladder and took the ladder down and laid it by the wall and went back in and went to bed. Outside, the snow fell softly. He woke in the night with some premonition of ill fate. He sat up. The fire had diminished to a single tongue of flame that stood near motionless from the ashes. He lit the lamp and turned up the wick. A shifting mantle of smoke overhung the room. Thick ribbons of white smoke were seeping down between the boards in the ceiling, and he could hear a light crackling noise overhead, like something feeding. "Oh, shit," he said. He got up, the blanket shawled about his thin and angry shoulders. Through the rives in the boards above him, he could see a hellish glow of hot orange. He was pulling on his jacket and shoes. With the rifle in hand, he went out into the snow. There, in the trampled weed lot, he stood looking up at the roof. A crazy-looking gaggle of flames shot up alongside the chimney and subsided again. A rabid crackling from the loft. Clouds of steam were coming off the wet roof, and hot pins of light drifted downwind in the blowing snow.
"Kiss my goddamned ass," said Ballard.
He stood the rifle against a tree and hurried back inside and gathered up his bedding and hauled it out into the snow and dove back in again. He collected his cookware and his little pantry and brought them out, and he got the axe and the few tools he owned and what other odds and ends of gear he had stowed in the empty room and flung them into the yard and raced back in and got the ladder and stood it up into the hole and looked up. Huge orange boils of fire were pulsing in the loft. He climbed up the ladder and poked his head through the hole in the ceiling. Instantly, he felt his hair singe and crackle. He ducked and patted at his head. Already, his eyes were red and weeping from the smoke. He squatted there at the top of the ladder for a few minutes, squinting up at the fire, and then he climbed back down again. When he went back outside, he had the bears and the tiger in his arms. The roof was now afire. Above the steady roar of it, you could hear the old riven oak shakes exploding into flame row on row at the far end of the house with a kind of popping noise. The heat was marvelous. Ballard stood there in the snow with his jaw hanging. The flames ran down the bat boards and up again like burning squirrels. Through the flames of the roof, you could see the pinned framing in a row of burning A shapes. Within minutes, the cabin was a solid wall of fire. The few panes of glass crackled and fell from their sash in a myriad rupture, and the roof dropped with a whooshing noise down into the house. Ballard had to step back, so great the heat was. The snow about the house had begun to draw back, leaving a ring of damp ground. After a while, the ground began to steam. Long before morning, the house that had kept Ballard from the elements was only a blackened chimney with a pile of smoldering boards at its feet. Ballard crossed the soggy ground and climbed onto the hearth and sat there like an owl, for the warmth of it. He'd long been given to talking to himself, but he didn't say a word. It was still dark in the morning when he woke with the cold. He'd piled dead weeds and brush to lay the mattress on and gone to sleep with his feet to the embers of the house, snowflakes falling on him from out of the blackness of the heavens. The snow melted on him and then, in the colder hours of morning, froze so that he woke beneath a blanket of ice that cracked like glass when he stirred. He hobbled to the hearth in his thin jacket and tried to warm himself. It was still snowing lightly, and he knew not what hour it might be. When he had stopped shivering, he got his pan and filled it with snow and set it among the embers. While it was heating, he found the axe and cut two poles with which to hang the blanket to dry. When day came, he was sitting in a nest of weeds he'd made on the hearth, and he was sipping coffee from a large porcelain cup which he held in both hands. With the advent of this sad gray light, he shook the last few drops out of the cup and climbed down from his perch and began to poke through the ashes with a stick. He spent the better part of the morning stirring through the ruins until he was black with wood ash to the knees and his hands were black and his face streaked with black where he'd scratched or puzzled. He found not so much as a bone. It was as if she'd never been. Finally, he gave it up. He dusted the snow from the remainder of his provisions and fixed himself two bologna sandwiches and squatted in a warm place among the ashes eating them. Black fingerprints on the pale bread, eyes dark and huge and vacant. With the blanket load of provisions over his shoulder, he looked like some crazy winter gnome clambering up through the snow-filled woods on the side of the mountain. He came on, falling and sliding and cursing. It took him an hour to get to the cave. The second trip, he carried the axe and the rifle and a lard pail filled with hot coals from the fire at the house. The entrance to the cave was no more than a crawlway, and Ballard was slick with red mud down the front of him from going in and out. Inside, there was a large room with a bore of light that climbed slantwise from the red clay floor to a hole in the roof like an incandescent tree trunk. Ballard blew up a flame from wisps of dry grass with his coals, and assembled the lamp and lit it and kicked at the remains of an old fire in the center of the cave beneath the roof hole. He came dragging in slabs of hardwood from the upright shells of dead trees on the mountain, and soon he had a good fire going in the cave. When he started back down the mountain for the mattress, a steady plume of white smoke was rising from the hole in the ground behind him. The weather did not change. Ballard took to wandering over the mountain through the snow to his old home place where he'd watched the house, the house's new tenant. He'd go in the night and lie up on the bank and watch him through the kitchen window, or from the top of the well house, where he would see into the front room where Greer sat before Ballard's very stove with his sock feet up. Greer wore spectacles and read what looked like seed catalogs. Ballard laid the rifle foresight on his chest. He swung it upward to a spot just above the ear. His finger filled the cold curve of the trigger. "Bang," he said. Ballard stamped the snow from his shoes and leaned his rifle against the side of the house and tapped at the door. He glanced about. The sofa lay mantled in snow, and over the snow lay a fine stippling of coal soot and cat tracks. Behind the house stood the remains of several cars, and from the rear glass of one of them, a turkey watched him. The door fell open, and the dump keeper stood there in his shirt sleeves and suspenders.
"Come in, Lester," he said.
Ballard entered, his eyes wheeling about, his face stretched in a China smile. But there was no one to see. A young girl was sitting on a car seat holding a baby, and when Ballard came in, she got up and went into the other room.
"Get over here and warm before you take your death," said the dump keeper, making for the stove.
"Where's everybody at?" said Ballard.
"Shoot," said the dump keeper. "They've all left out of here."
"The missus ain't left, is she?" "Oh, no.
She's a-visitin' her sister and them. Every one of the girls has left, savin' the least un, though. We still got two of the babies here."
"How come 'em to all leave of a sudden like that?"
"I don't know," said the dump keeper. "Young people these days, you can't tell 'em nothin'. You ought to be proud, Lester, that you ain't never married. It is a grief and a heartache, and there ain't no reward in it at all. You just raise enemies in ye own house to grow up and cuss ye."
Ballard turned his backside to the stove.
"Well," he said, "I never could see it."
"That's where you're smart," said the dump keeper.
Ballard agreed mutely, shaking his head.
"I heard you got burned out over at your place," the dump keeper said.
"Plumb to the ground," said Ballard. "You never seen such fire."
"What caused it?"
"I don't know. It started in the attic. I believe it must have been sparks from the chimney."
"Was you asleep?"
"Yeah. I just did get out of there."
"What did Waldrop say?"
"I don't know. I ain't seen him. I ain't looking for him."
"Be proud you wasn't like old man Parton up here. Got burned down in his bed that time."
Ballard turned around and warmed his hands at the stove.
"Did they ever find any of him?" he said.
When he got to the head of the hollow, he rested, watching behind him the while.
The tracks he followed had water standing in them, and they went up the mountain, but they didn't come back down. He lost them later and found some different ones, and he spent the afternoon in the woods, stalking about like any hunter, but when he returned to the cave just short of nightfall with his feet numb in the leaky shoes, he hadn't found any of the whiskey, and he hadn't seen Kirby. He ran into Greer the next morning. It had begun to rain, a small, cold winter rain that Ballard cursed. He lowered his head and tucked the rifle under his arm and stepped to one side to pass, but the other would not have it so.
"Howdy," he said.
"Howdy," said Ballard.
"You're Ballard, ain't ye?"
Ballard didn't raise his head. He was watching the man's shoes there in the wet leaves of the overgrown logging road. He said,
"No, I ain't him,"
and went on.
"Lord, they caught me, Lester," said Kirby.
"Caught ye?
I'm on 3-year probation."
Ballard stared around the little room with its linoleum floor and cheap furniture.
"Well, kiss my ass," he said.
"Ain't it a bitch? I never thought about them being niggers."
"Niggers?
They sent niggers. That's who I sold to. Sold to them 3 times. One of them sat right there in that chair and drunk a pint. Drunk it and got up and walked out and got in the car. I don't see how he done it. He might have drove for all I know. They caught everybody. Got old Lady Bright up in Cock County even, and she'd been selling whiskey nonstop since 4 I was born."
Ballard leaned and spat into a can sitting in the floor.
"Well, fuck it," he said.
"I sure would have never thought about them sending niggers," said Kirby.
Ballard stood at the door. There was no car in the driveway. A pale yellow trapezoid of light lay in the mud beneath the window. Within, the idiot child crawled in the floor, and the girl was curled on the sofa reading a magazine. He raised his hand and tapped. When the door opened, he was standing there, already wearing his sickish smile, his lips dry and tight over his teeth.
"Howdy," he said.
"He ain't here," said the girl.
She stood hip-loose in the door frame and regarded him with frank indifference.
"What time you expect him?"
"I don't know. He's took Mama to church. They won't be back for 10:30 or 11.
"Well," said Ballard.
She said nothing.
"Turned off cool, ain't it?"
"It is, standing here with the door open."
"Well, ain't you going to ask me in for a minute?"
She thought about it before she swung the door back. You could see it in her eyes. But she let him in. More's the fool. He entered shuffling, beating his hands together.
"How's that big boy?"
he said.
"He's crazy as ever,"
she said, headed for the sofa and her magazine. Ballard squatted before the stained and drooling cretin and tousled its near bald head.
"Why, that boy's got good sense," he said. "Ain't ye?"
"Shoot,"
said the girl. Ballard eyed her. She was wearing pink slacks of cheap cotton, and she sat on the sofa with her legs crossed under her and a pillow in her lap. He rose and went to the stove and stood with his back to it. The stove was enclosed waist-high in a chicken-wire fence. The posts were toe-nailed to the floor, and the fencing was nailed down as well.
"I bet he could push this over if he wanted to," said Ballard.
"I'd smack the fire out of him, too," said the girl.
Ballard was watching her. He narrowed his eyes cunningly and smiled.
"He's yourn, ain't he?" he said.
The girl's face snapped up.
"You're crazy as shit," she said.
Ballard leered. Steam sifted up from his dark trouser legs.
"You can't fool me,"
he said.
"You're a liar,"
the girl said.
"You wished I was. You better hush."
Ballard turned to warm his front side. A car passed in the road. They both craned their necks to follow the lights along. She turned back and saw him and made a chicken-necked grimace to mock him. The child in the floor sat drooling, nor had it moved.
"Wouldn't be that old crazy Thomas boy, would it?" said Ballard.
The girl glared at him. Her face was flushed and her eyes red.
"You ain't slipped off in the bushes with that old crazy thing, have ye? You better shut your mouth, Lester Ballard. I'll tell Daddy on you. I'll tell Daddy on you, whined Ballard. You just wait and see if I don't.
Shoot, said Ballard. I was just teasing ye.
Why don't you go on?
I guess you too young to know when a man's teasing ye.
You ain't even a man. You're just a crazy thing.
I might be more than you think, said Ballard. How come you wear them breeches?
What's it to you?
Ballard's mouth was dry. You can't see nothing, he said. She looked at him blankly, then she reddened.
I ain't got nothing for you to see, she said.
Ballard took a few wooden steps toward the sofa and then stopped in the middle of the floor.
Why don't you show me them nice titties?
He said hoarsely. She stood up and pointed at the door.
You get out of here, she said. Right now.
Come on, Ballard wheezed. I won't ask ye nothing else.
Lester Ballard, when Daddy comes home, he's going to kill you. Now, I said get out of here, and I mean it.
She stamped her foot. Ballard looked at her.
All right, he said. If that's the way you want it.
He went to the door and opened it, and went out and shut the door behind him. He heard her latch it. The night out there was clear and cold, and the moon sat in a great ring in the sky. Ballard's breath rose whitely toward the dark of the heavens. He turned and looked back at the house. She was watching from the corner of the window. He went on down the broken driveway to the road, and crossed the ditch, and went along the edge of the yard, and crossed back up to the house. He picked up the rifle where he'd left it leaning against a crabapple tree, and he went along the side of the house and stepped up onto a low wall of cinder block and went along it past the clothesline and the coal pile to where he could see in the window there. He could see the back of her head above the sofa. He watched her for a while, and then he raised the rifle and cocked it and laid the sights on her head. He had just done this when suddenly she rose from the sofa and turned, facing the window. Ballard fired. The crack of the rifle was outrageously loud in the cold silence. Through the spider glass, he saw her slouch and stand again. He levered another shell into the chamber and raised the rifle, and then she fell. He reached down and scrabbled about in the frozen mud for the empty shell, but he couldn't find it. He raced around the house to the front and mounted the spindly steps and came up short against the door.
You dumb son of a bitch, he said. You heard her lock it.
He leaped to the ground and ran to the back of the house and entered a low-screened porch and pushed open the kitchen door and went through and into the front room. She was lying in the floor, but she wasn't dead. She was moving. She seemed to be trying to get up. A thin stream of blood ran across the yellow linoleum rug and seeped away darkly in the wood of the floor. Ballard gripped the rifle and watched her.
Die, goddamn you, he said.
She did. When she had ceased moving, he went about the room gathering up newspapers and magazines and shredding them. The idiot watched mutely. Ballard ripped away the chicken wire from around the stove and pushed the stove over with his foot. The pipe crashed into the room in a cloud of coal soot. He snatched open the stove door and hot embers rolled out. He piled on papers. Soon, a fire going in the middle of the room. Ballard raised up the dead girl. She was slick with blood. He got her onto his shoulder and looked around, the rifle. It was leaning against the sofa. He got it and looked about wildly. Already the ceiling of the room was packed with seething tears of smoke, and small fires licked along the bare wood floor at the edge of the linoleum. As he whirled about there in the kitchen door, the last thing he saw through the smoke was the idiot child. It sat watching him, berry-eyed, filthy, and frightless among the painted flames. Ballard was walking the road near the top of the mountain when the sheriff pulled up behind him in the car. The sheriff told Ballard to put the rifle down, but Ballard didn't move. He stood there by the side of the road, straight up and down with the rifle in one hand, and he didn't even turn around to see who'd spoke. The sheriff reached his pistol out the window and cocked it. You could hear, very clearly in the cold air, the click of the hammer and the click of the hand dropping into the cylinder locking notch.
"Boy, you better stick it in the ground," the sheriff said.
Ballard stood the butt of the rifle in the road and let go of it. It fell into the roadside bushes.
"Turn around. Now, come over here. Now, just stand there a minute. Now, get in here. Now, hold your hands out.
If you leave my rifle there, somebody's going to get it.
I'll worry about your goddamned rifle."
The man behind the desk had folded his hands in front of him, as if about to pray. He gazed at Ballard across the tips of his fingers.
"Well," he said, "if you hadn't done anything wrong, what were you scouting the bushes for that nobody could find you?"
"I know how they do ye," Ballard muttered. "Throw ye in jail, beat the shit out of ye."
"This man ever been mistreated down here, Sheriff?" "He knows better'n that. They tell me you cussed Deputy Walker." "Well, did you? What are you looking over there for?"
"I was just looking."
"Mr. Walker's not going to tell you what to say."
"He might tell me what not to."
"Is it true that you burned down Mr. Waltrip's house?"
"No."
"You were living in it at the time that it burned."
"I wasn't done it. I'd left out of there a long time for that."
It was quiet in the room. After a while, the man behind the desk lowered his hands and folded them in his lap.
"Mr. Ballard," he said, "you are either going to have to find some other way to live, or some other place in the world to do it in."
Ballard entered the store and slammed the iron barred door behind him. The store was empty save for Mr. Fox, who nodded to this small and harried-looking customer. The customer did not nod back. He went along the shelves, picking and choosing among the goods, the cans all marshaled with their labels to the front, wrenching holes in their ordered rows and stacking them on the counter in front of the storekeeper. Finally, he fetched up in front of the meat case. Mr. Fox rose and donned a white apron, old bloodstains bleached light pink, tied it in the back and approached the meat case and switched on a light that illuminated rolls of bologna and rounds of cheese and a tray of thin-sliced pork chops among the sausages and souse meat.
"Slice me about a half pound of that there bologna," said Ballard.
Mr. Fox fetched it out and laid it on the butcher block and took up a knife and began to pare away thin slices. These he doled up one at a time onto a piece of butcher paper. When he had done, he laid down the knife and placed the paper in the scales. He and Ballard watched the needle swing.
"What else now?"
said the storekeeper, tying up the package of meat with a string.
"Give me some of that there cheese."
He bought a sack of cigarette tobacco and stood there rolling a smoke and nodding at the groceries.
"Add them up," he said.
The storekeeper figured the merchandise on his scratch pad, sliding the goods from one side of the counter to the other as he went. He raised up and pushed his glasses back with his thumb.
$5.10, he said.
"Just put it on the stob for me."
"Ballard, when are you going to pay me?"
"Well, I can give you some on it today."
"How much on it?"
"Well, say $3.
The storekeeper was figuring on his pad.
"How much do I owe altogether?" said Ballard.
$34.19.
"Including this here?"
"Including this here."
"Well, but let me just give ye the $4.19, and that'll leave it 30 even."
The storekeeper looked at Ballard.
"Ballard," he said, "how old are you?"
27, if it's any of your business."
27.
"And in 27 years you've managed to accumulate $4.19? The storekeeper was figuring on his pad. Ballard waited.
"What are you figuring?"
he asked suspiciously.
"Just a minute," said the storekeeper.
After a while he raised the pad up and squinted at it.
"Well," he said, "according to my figures, at this rate it's going to take 194 years to pay out the $30. Ballard, I'm 67 now."
Why, that's crazy. Of course this is figured if you don't buy nothing else. Why, that's crazier than hell.
Well, I could have made a mistake in the figures. Did you want to check 'em?
Ballard pushed at the scratch pad the storekeeper was offering him.
I don't want to see that, he said.
Well, what I think I'm going to do along in here is just try to minimize my losses. So if you've got $4.19, why don't you just get $4.19 worth of groceries?
Ballard's face was twitching.
What did you want to put back? Said the storekeeper.
I ain't putting a goddamn thing back, said Ballard,
laying out the $5 and slapping down the dime. Ballard crossed the mountain into Blount County one Sunday morning in the early part of February. There's a spring on the side of the mountain that runs from solid stone. Kneeling in the snow among the fairy tracks of birds and deer mice, Ballard leaned his face to the green water and drank, and studied his dishing visage in the pool. He halfway put his hand to the water as if he would touch the face that watched there, but then he rose and wiped his mouth and went on through the woods. Old woods, and deep. At one time in the world there were woods that no one owned, and these were like them. He passed a wind-felled tulip poplar on the mountainside that held aloft in the grip of its roots two stones the size of field wagons, great tablets on which was writ only a tale of vanished seas, with an ancient shells in cameo and fishes etched in lime. Ballard, among Gothic tree boles, almost jaunty in the outsized clothing he wore, fording drifts of knee-deep snow, going along the south face of a limestone bluff beneath which birds, scratching in the bare earth, paused to watch. The road, when he reached it, was unmarked by any track at all. Ballard descended into it and went on. It was almost noon, and the sun was very bright on the snow, and the snow shone with a myriad crystal incandescence. The shrouded road wound off before him, almost lost among the trees, and a stream ran beside the road, dark under bowers of ice, small, glass-fanged caverns beneath tree roots where the water sucked unseen. In the frozen roadside weeds were coiled white ribbons of frost. You'd never figure how they came to be. Ballard ate one as he went, the rifle on his shoulder, his feet enormous with snow where it clung to the sacks with which he'd wrapped them. By and by, he came upon a house, silent in the silent landscape, a rough scarf of smoke unwinding upward from the chimney. There were tire tracks in the road, but they had been snowed over in the night. Ballard came on down the mountain, past more houses and past the ruins of a tannery, into a road freshly traveled, the corded tracks of tire chains curving away into the white woods and a jade river curving away toward the mountains to the south. When he got to the store, he sat on a box on the porch, and with his pocket knife, cut the twine that bound his legs and feet, and took off the sacks, and shook them out, and laid them on the box with the pieces of twine, and stood up. He was wearing black low-cut shoes that were longer than he would have needed. The rifle he'd left under the bridge as he crossed the river. He stamped his feet, and opened the door and went in. A group of men and boys were gathered about the stove, and they stopped talking when Ballard entered. Ballard went to the back of the stove, nodding slightly to the store's inhabitants. He held his hands to the heat and looked casually about.
"Cold enough for yins?" he said.
Nobody said if it was or wasn't. Ballard coughed and rubbed his hands together and crossed to the drink box and got an orange drink and opened it and got a cake and paid at the counter. The storekeeper dropped the dime into the till and shut the drawer. He said,
"It's a sight in the world of snow, ain't it?"
Ballard agreed that it was, leaning on the counter, eating the cake and taking small sips from the drink. After a while he leaned toward the storekeeper.
"You ain't needin' a watch, are ye?"
he said.
"What?"
said the storekeeper.
"A watch? Did you need a watch?"
The storekeeper looked at Ballard blankly.
"A watch?" he said. "What kind of a watch?"
"I got different kinds here."
Ballard setting down his drink and half-eaten cake on the counter and reaching into his pockets. He pulled forth three wristwatches and laid them out. The storekeeper poked at them once or twice with his finger.
"I don't need no watch," he said. "I got some in the counter yonder, been there a year."
Ballard looked where he was pointing, a few dusty watches and cellophane packets among the socks and hairnets.
"What do you get for yourn?" he asked.
$8.
Ballard eyed the merchant's watches doubtfully.
"Well," he said.
He finished the cake and took up his own watches by their straps and took his drink and crossed the floor to the stove again. He held the watches out, tendering them uncertainly at the man nearest him.
"Y'all don't need a wristwatch, do ye?" he said.
The man glanced at the watches and glanced away.
"Let's see 'em over here, old buddy,"
said a fat boy by the stove. Ballard handed the watches across.
"What do you want for 'em?" "I thought I'd get $5.
"What? For all three of 'em?"
"Why, hell no, $5 each."
"Shit. Let's see that, Norvis."
"Now, wait a minute, I'm looking at it." "Let's see it. That there's a good watch."
"Let me have it. What will you take for this'n?"
$5.
"I'll give you two and won't ask you where you got it."
"I can't do it."
"Let me see that other'n, Fred. What's wrong with 'em?"
"Ain't a damn thing wrong with 'em. You hear 'em running, don't ye?"
"I'll give you three for that there gold-looking one."
Ballard looked from one to the other of them.
"I'll take four," he said, "and pick your choice."
"What do you take for all of 'em?"
Ballard totted figures in the air for a moment.
$12, he said.
"Why, hell, that ain't no deal. Don't you get a discount on job lots?"
"Is them all the watches you got?"
"Just them three is all."
"Here, hand 'em these in back."
"Ain't you going to get in the watch business today, Orvis?"
"I can't get my jobber to come down."
"What do you give for 'em?" said Ballard.
"I'll give $8 for the three of 'em."
Ballard looked about at the men. They were watching him to see what price used watches would bring this Sunday morning. He weighed the watches in his hand a moment and handed them across.
"You bought 'em," he said.
The watch buyer rose and handed across the money and took the watches.
"You want this 'un for three?" he said to the man next to him.
"Yeah, let me have it."
"Anybody else want one for three?"
He held up the spare watch. The other man, who had been looking at the watches, straightened out his leg across the floor and reached into his pocket.
"I'll take it off of you," he said.
"What do you take for that 'un you got, Orvis?"
"Might take five."
"Shit. You ain't got but two in it."
"This here's a good watch."
When Ballard reached the river, he looked about the empty white countryside and then dropped down off the road and under the bridge. Coming up the river were tracks not his own. Ballard scrambled up under the stanchions and reached up to the beam atop which he'd left the rifle. There for a moment he flailed wildly, his hand scrabbling along the concrete, his eye to the river and the tracks there, which already he was trailing to the end of his life. Then his hand closed upon the stock of the rifle. He fetched it down, cursing, his heart hammering.
"You'd try it, wouldn't ye?"
he wailed at the tracks in the snow. His voice, beneath the arches of the bridge, came back hollow and alien, and Ballard listened to the echo of it with his head tilted like a dog, and then he climbed the bank and started back up the road. It was dark when he reached the cave. He crawled through and lit a match and got the lamp and lit it and set it by the ring of stones that marked the fire pit. The nearer walls of the cavern composed themselves out of the constant night with their pale stone drapery folds, and a fault line in the vault ceiling appeared with a row of dripping limestone teeth. In the black smoke hole overhead, the remote and lidless stars of the Pleiades burned cold and absolute. Ballard kicked at the fire and turned a few dull cherry coals up out of the ash and bones. He fetched dry grass and twigs and lit the fire and went back out with his pan and brought it in filled with snow and set it by the fire. His mattress lay in a pile of brush with the stuffed animals upon it, and his other few possessions lay about in the grotto where chance had arranged them. When he had the fire going, he took his flashlight and went across the room and disappeared down a narrow passageway. Ballard made his way by damp stone corridors down inside the mountain to another room. Here his light scudded across a growth of limestone columns and what looked like huge stone urns, moist and ill-shapen. From the floor of the room, an underground stream rose. It welled up blackly in a calcite basin and flowed down a narrow aqueduct where the room tailed off through a black hole. Ballard's light glanced from the surface of the pool unaltered, as if bent back by some strange underground force. Everywhere water dripped and spattered, and the wet cave walls looked waxed or lacquered in the beam of light. He crossed the room and followed the stream out and down the narrow gorge through which it flowed, the water rushing off into the darkness before him, descending from pool to pool in stone cups of its own devising, and Ballard nimble over the rocks and along a ledge, keeping his feet dry, straddling the water course at points. His light picking out on the pale stone floor of the stream white crawfish that backed and turned blindly. He followed this course for perhaps a mile down all its turnings and through narrows that fetched him sideways, advancing like a fencer, and through a tunnel that brought him to his belly. The smell of the water beside him in the trough, rich with minerals, and past the chalk and dung of he knew not what animals, until he climbed up a chimney to a corridor above the stream and entered into a tall and bell-shaped cavern. Here the walls with their soft-looking convolutions, slavered over as they were with wet and blood-red mud, had an organic look to them, like the innards of some great beast. Here, in the bowels of the mountain, Ballard turned his light on ledges or pallets of stone, where dead people lay like saints. A winter dreadful cold it was. He thought before it was over that he would look like one of the bitter spruces that grew slant downwind out of the shale and lichens on the Hogback. Coming up the mountain through the blue winter twilight among great boulders and the ruins of giant trees prone in the forest, he wondered at such upheaval. Disorder in the woods, trees down, new paths needed. Given charge, Ballard would have made things more orderly in the woods and in men's souls. It snowed again. It snowed for 4 days, and when Ballard went down the mountain again, it took him the best part of the morning to cross to the ridge above Greer's place. There he could hear the chuck of an axe muted with distance and snowfall. He could see nothing. The snow was gray against the sky, soft on his lashes. It fell without a sound. Ballard cradled the rifle in his arm and made his way down the slope toward the house. He crouched behind the barn, listening for sound of Greer. There in the frozen mire of mud and dung, deeply plugged with hoofprints. When he came through the barn, it was empty. The loft was filled with hay. Ballard stood in the four-bay door, looking down through the falling snow at the gray shape of the house. He crossed to the chicken house and undid the wire that held the hasp and entered. A few white hens eyed him nervously from their cubby nests on the far wall. Ballard passed along a row of roosting rails and went through a chicken wire door to the feed room. There he loaded his pockets with shelled corn and came back. He surveyed the hens, clucked his tongue at them, and reached for one. It erupted from the box with a long squawk and flapped past and lit in the floor and trotted off. Ballard cursed. In the uproar, the other hens were following by ones and pairs. He lunged and grabbed one by the tail as it came soaring out. It set up an outraged shrieking until Ballard could get it by the neck. Holding the struggling bird in both hands and with his rifle between his knees, he crow-hopped to the small dust-webbed window and peered out. Nothing stirred.
"You son of a bitch," said Ballard to the chicken, or Greer, or both.
He wrung the hen's neck and went quickly through the nesting boxes, gathering up the few eggs and putting them in his pockets, and then He went out again. In the spring or warmer weather, when the snow thaws in the woods and tracks of winter reappear on slender pedestals, and the snow reveals in palimpsest old buried wanderings, struggles, scenes of death, tales of winter brought to light again, like time turned back upon itself. Ballard went through the woods, kicking down his old trails where they veered over the hill toward his one-time home place. Old comings and goings. The tracks of a fox raised out of the snow, intaglio, like little mushrooms and berry stains where birds shat crimson mutes upon the snow like blood. When he reached the overlook, he stood his rifle against the stones and watched the house below him. There was no smoke coming from the chimney. Ballard watched with his arms folded. He asked Greer where he was today. A gray and colder day, with all the melting snow ceased from its dripping and runneling. Ballard watched the first flakes fall like ash into the valley.
"Where are you, you bastard?" he called.
Two minute doilies of snow settled and perished on the crossed arms of his coat. He watched until the silent house grew dim below him in the gray snowfall. After a while, he took up the rifle once again and crossed the ridge to where he could see the road. There was nobody going up or down. Already the snow was falling so that you could not see up the valley at all. A spray of small birds came out of the snowfall and passed like wind-blown leaves into the silence again. Ballard crouched on his heels with the rifle between his knees. He told the snow to fall faster, and it did. After the snow ceased, he went every day. He'd watch from his half-mile promontory, see Greer come from the house for wood or go to the barn or to the chicken house. After he'd gone in again, Ballard would wander about aimlessly in the woods, talking to himself. He laid queer plans, his shuffling boot tracks trampling out the prints of lesser life, where mice had gone or foxes hunting in the night, the dove-like imprimatur of a stooping owl. He'd long been wearing the underclothes of his female victims, but now he took to appearing in their outerwear as well. A gothic doll in ill-fit clothes, its carmine mouth floating detached and bright in the white landscape. Down there in the valley with a few rust-stained roofs and faintest wisps of smoke, the ribboned slash of mud that the road made up the white valley, and beyond it the fold-on-fold of mountains with their black weirs of winter tree limbs and dull green cedars. His own tracks came from the cave blood-red with cave mud and paled across the slope as if the snow had cauterized his feet until he left dry white prints in the snow. False spring came again with a warm wind. The snow melted off into little patches of gray ice among the wet leaves. With the advent of this weather, bats began to stir from somewhere deep in the cave. Ballard, lying on his pallet by the fire one evening, saw them come from the dark of the tunnel and ascend through the hole overhead, fluttering wildly in the ash and smoke like souls rising from Hades. When they were gone, he watched the hordes of cold stars sprawled across the smoke hole and wondered what stuff they were made of, or himself. Part 3.
"Yonder it is, Sheriff," said the sheriff's deputy.
"All right, go on to the top and turn around."
They drove on up the deeply mired road, fishtailing slightly and unreeling long slabs of wet mud from under the tires until they came to the loop at the end of the road. Coming back down, you could see the ruts where they went off into the weeds, and you could see where the young trees were crushed and where the tire tracks went on down the side of the mountain.
"Yonder she lays," said the deputy.
The car was turned on its side in a deep ravine some 100 feet below them. The sheriff wasn't looking at it. He was looking back up the road toward the turnaround.
"I wished we'd been here 3 days ago when there was still some snow on the ground," he said. "Let's go on down and look at it."
They stood on the side of the car and raised the door up, and the deputy descended into the interior. After a while, he said,
"There ain't a damn thing in here, Sheriff."
"What about in the glove box?"
"Not a thing."
"Look up under the seats."
"I done looked."
"Look some more."
When he came up out of the car, he had a bottle cap in his hand. He handed it to the sheriff.
"What's that?"
said the sheriff.
"That's it."
The sheriff looked at the bottle cap.
"Let's get the turtle deck open," he said.
In the trunk was a spare tire and a jack and a lug wrench and some rags and two empty bottles. The sheriff was standing with his hands in his pockets, looking back up the side of the ravine toward the road.
"If you wanted to get from here to the road," he said, "which you would if you was here, how would you go?"
The deputy pointed.
"I'd go right up that there gully," he said.
"So would I," said the sheriff.
"Where do you reckon he went?"
"I don't know."
"How long'd you say his old lady says he's been gone?"
"Since Sunday evening."
"They sure the girl was with him?"
"So they say. They was engaged."
"Maybe they took off through the woods or something."
"They wasn't in the car," the sheriff said.
"They wasn't?"
"No."
"Well, how did it get here?"
"I believe somebody shoved it off in here."
"Well, maybe they run off together. Might better find out how much he owed on the car. That could be what
I done have. It's paid for."
The deputy nudged a few small stones with the toe of his boot. After a while, he looked up.
"Well," he said, "where do you reckon they've got to?"
"I reckon they've got to wherever that gal got to that was supposed to be with that boy we found up here."
"She was supposed to have been going with that Blaylock boy we talked to."
"Yeah, well, these young people keep pretty active, some of them. Let's go up here."
They walked up the road to the turnaround. On the far side, they found shoe tracks in the mud along the edge of the road. Further down the circle, they found more. The sheriff just sort of nodded at them.
"What do you reckon, Sheriff?" said the deputy.
"Why, nothing. It could just be where somebody got out to piss."
He was looking off down the road.
"Do you reckon," he said, "that if you was to shove a car off from along in here, it might get as far as where we're parked down yonder before it left the road?"
The deputy looked with him.
"Well," he said, "it's possible. I say it might could."
"So would I," said the sheriff.
Ballard's new shoes sucked in the mud as he approached the pickup truck. He had the rifle under his arm and the flashlight in his hand. When he got to the truck, he opened the door and flicked the light on, and trapped in its yellow beam the white faces of a boy and a girl in each other's arms. The girl was the first to speak. She said,
"He's got a gun."
Ballard's head was numb. They seemed assembled there, the three of them, for some purpose other than his. He said,
"Let's see your driver's license."
"You ain't the law,"
the boy said.
"I'll be the judge of that," said Ballard. "What are y'all doing up here?"
"We was just settin' here,"
the girl said. She wore a sprig of gauze ferns at her shoulder with two roses of burgundy crepe.
"You was fixin' to screw, wasn't ye?"
He watched their faces.
"You better watch your mouth," the boy said.
"You want to make me? You put down that rifle and I will." "Anytime you feel froggy, jump," said Ballard.
The boy reached to the dashboard and turned on the ignition and began to crank the engine.
"Quit it," said Ballard.
The engine did not start. The boy had raised his hand as if he would bat at the rifle barrel when Ballard shot him through the neck. He fell sideways into the girl's lap. She folded her hands and put them under her chin.
"Oh, no,"
she said. Ballard levered another shell into the chamber.
"I told that fool," he said. "Didn't I tell him? I don't know why people don't want to listen."
The girl looked at the boy, and then she looked up at Ballard. She was holding her hands in the air, as if she didn't know where to put them. She said,
"What did you have to go and do that for?"
"It was up to him," said Ballard. "I told the idiot."
"Oh, God,"
said the girl.
"You better get out of there."
"What?"
"Out. Come on out of there."
"What are you going to do?"
"That's for me to know and you to find out."
The girl pushed the boy from her and slid across the seat and stepped out into the mud of the road.
"Turn around," Ballard said.
"What are you going to do?"
"Just turn around and never mind."
"I have to go to the bathroom,"
the girl said.
"You don't need to worry about that," said Ballard.
Turning her by the shoulder, he laid the muzzle of the rifle at the base of her skull and fired. She dropped as if the bones in her body had been liquefied. Ballard tried to catch her, but she slumped into the mud. He got hold of her dress by the nape to raise her, but the material parted in his fist, and in the end, he had to stand the rifle against the fender of the truck and take her under the arms. He dragged her through the weeds, walking backwards, watching over his shoulder. Her head was lolling, and blood ran down her neck, and Ballard had dragged her out of her shoes. He was breathing harshly, and his eyeballs were wild and white. He laid her down in the woods not 50 feet from the road and threw himself on her, kissing the still warm mouth and feeling under her clothes. Suddenly, he stopped and raised up. He lifted her skirt and looked down at her. She had wet herself. He cursed and pulled down the panties and dabbed at the pale thighs with the hem of the girl's skirt. He had his trousers about his knees when he heard the truck start. The sound he made was not unlike the girl's, a dry sucking of air, mute with terror. He leaped up, hauling at his breeches, and tore through the brush toward the road. A crazed mountain troll, clutching up a pair of blood-stained breeches by one hand and calling out in a high, mad gibbering, bursting from the woods and hurtling down the gravel road behind a lightless truck receding, half-obscured in rising dust. He pounded down the mountain till he could run no more, nor had he breath to call after. Before long, he had stopped to buckle his belt, and he went lurching on, holding his side, slumped and breathing hard, and saying to himself, "You won't get far, you dead son of a bitch." He was halfway down the mountain before he realized he didn't have the rifle. He stopped. Then he went on anyway. When he came out on the valley road, he looked down toward the highway. The road in the moonlight lay beneath a lightly sustained trail of dust, like a river under a mantle of mist, and for as far as he could see, Ballard's heart lay in his chest like a stone. He squatted in the dust of the road until his breathing eased. Then he rose and started back up the mountain again. He tried to run at first, but he couldn't. It took him almost an hour to make the 3 miles back to the top. He found the rifle where it had fallen from the truck fender, and he checked it and went on into the woods. She was lying as he had left her, and she was cold and wooden with death. Ballard howled curses until he was choking, and then he knelt and worked her around onto his shoulders and struggled up. Scuttling down the mountain with the thing on his back, he looked like a man beset by some gassed succubus, the dead girl riding him with legs bowed akimbo like a monstrous frog. Ballard watched them from the saddle in the mountain, a small thing brooding there, squatting with a rifle in his arms. It had been raining for 3 days. The creek far below him, out of its banks, the fields flooded. Sheets of standing water spotted with winter weeds and fodder. Ballard's hair hung from his thin skull in lank wet strings, and gray water dripped from his hair and from the end of his nose. In the night, the side of the mountain winked with lamps and torches. Late winter revelers among the trees, or some like hunters calling each to each there in the dark. In the dark, Ballard passed beneath them, scuttling with his ragged chattel down stone tunnels within the mountain. Toward dawn, he emerged from a hole in a rock on the far side of the mountain and peered about like a groundhog before committing himself to the gray and rainy daylight. With his rifle in one hand and his blanket load of gear, he set off through the thin woods toward the cleared land beyond. He crossed a fence into a half-flooded field and made his way toward the creek. At the ford, it was more than twice its right width. Ballard studied the water and moved on downstream. After a while, he was back. The creek was totally opaque, a thick and brick-colored medium that hissed in the reeds. As he watched,
A drowned sow shot into the ford and spun slowly with pink and bloated dugs and went on. Ballard stashed the blanket in a stand of sedge and returned to the cave. When he got back to the creek, it seemed to have run yet higher. He carried a crate of odd miscellany, men's and ladies' clothes, the three enormous stuffed toys streaked with mud, adding to this load the rifle and the blanket full of things he'd carried down. He stepped into the water. The creek climbed his legs in wild bat wings. Ballard tottered and rebalanced and took a second grip on his load and went on. Before he even reached the creek bed, he was wading knee-deep. When it reached his waist, he began to curse aloud. A vitriol